This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November 18, 2009.
Today is Wednesday, November what? 18? 18? This is still dealing with chapter 15, the last three or four slides of it. We're reviewing quickly the enzyme called glycogen phosphorylase. This is an outline that demonstrates the pool of glycogen phosphorylase and the four forms that pool can be involved in. You have a phosphorylated form and you have an unphosphorylated form. Both forms can be activated. Once they're activated, they're called the B. They're called phosphorylase. They're just in the R form. And if it's phosphorylated, the predominant form is the active phosphorylase A. If they're not phosphorylated, the predominant form is the T form or the inactive form. So this demonstrates both covalent and allosteric modification for enzyme control. The phosphorylase kinase and the phosphoprotein phosphatase that do this particular mechanism are themselves controlled by a cascade that's controlled by external circumstances. This heterotrimeric G protein model of how G proteins interact and create a second messenger, one out of several that G proteins can make, are illustrated here. You need to be able to explain the process whereby an external stimulatory signal lands on a receptor and there is a cellular response. You need to be able to do that. Let's quickly run through this, shall we? And we will only take a minute to do this. An external signal lands on the receptor, some ligand. The receptor is, in fact, conformationally modified or changed, conformationally changed. There's not a permanent bound ligand. The change affects the inactive G trimer that's physically associated with the receptor. The inactive G primer, a trimer, has GDP in a GTPA site. The GDP indicates that that subunit is inactive. When the signal modifies the receptor and the receptor modifies its interaction with the G protein trimer, GDP is ejected and GTP is replaced. At that point, two things happen. There's a physical dissociation between the alpha, beta, and gamma subunits, and the stimulatory alpha subunit moves to activate the adenylate cyclase. But the stimulatory subunit is active only as long as there is a GTP in that site. That site, however, is a GTPase with a relatively low activity, which means at some time in the future, a few seconds, a few minutes, that GTP will be spontaneously hydrolyzed to GDT. When that happens, that deactivates the stimulatory subunit and the two beta and gamma subunits reassociate with the now inactive alpha subunit and reform and reassociate with the receptor. So the off key for the alpha subunit is the fact it's got a GTPase activity that slowly hydrolyzes the GTP, and turns itself off, essentially. In the process of turning on that AC, which stands for adenylate cyclase, it means it increases the production of cyclic AMP from ATP in the presence of that active or association with that active alpha subunit. That high level of cyclic AMP then begins to interact with a new protein called cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, or what's the other term? What was the other name for that enzyme? PKA. PKA. PKA comes with four pieces, two sets of identical subunits, two sets of a pair. The first is an R2R units, or regulatory units. They bind the catalytic subunits and inactivate it when the regulatory units do not have adenylate cyclase, cyclic AMP associated with it. When high levels of cyclic AMP are available, they bind to the regulatory subunits and release the catalytic subunits to be physically independent from the regulatory subunits. Those catalytic subunits, when they're independent from the regulatory subunits, now are catalytically active as a kinase. The kinase, and they take proteins for which they are a substrate for and put phosphate on them. Sometimes that turns it on, sometimes it turns it off. So that cellular response can either be a stimulatory or inhibitory response. Okay, here's the R2R subunits, here's the catalytic subunits, there's cyclic AMP. Notice there probably should be four of them here because each regulatory subunit can bind two of them. And when they bind those cyclic AMPs, they release the catalytic subunit, which becomes a kinase, and does the actual activation. Cyclic AMP in this case is called a second messenger. Second messenger. What was the first messenger? The signals, external signal. Is that correct? Now then, how does all that work to work on glycogen phosphorylase? Let's quickly review again. This diagram, which you have memorized before, is that correct? Is that to do today? Oh, the timing. We hit a sweet spot. Yes. All right. So we now have an idea of what's going to be going on here. Let's again take a look at the center here, which is probably where all the focus of the activity is. You see there are actually two enzyme activities here. One called glycogen phosphorylase and the other called glycogen synthase. There are two pools of glycogen phosphorylase. One inactive and not phosphated, and the other active and phosphated. So that pool of glycogen phosphorylase has two forms. Non-phosphorylated, inactive, phosphorylated, active. The synthase has also two pools of possible forms. One form is not phosphated and active, and the other is phosphated and inactive. So notice what the role of phosphorylation in each of these things does. With the glycogen phosphorylase, phosphorylating it turns it on. With the glycogen synthase pool, phosphorylase turns it off. Which makes metabolic sense because you don't need the breakdown and the synthesis occurring simultaneously. If you want the breakdown to occur, like this being turned on, you certainly would like to have the synthesis turned off. Why have a futile cycle? Well, there is a reason for a futile cycle, but we'll go into that perhaps later. But if the futile cycle is not here. So, how does glycogen phosphorylase get phosphated? How does glycogen synthase get phosphated? We'll be back to truck up here and look at the next layer of regulation. We see specifically that the glycogen phosphorylase has a particular and peculiar enzyme that phosphorylates it. It's called phosphorylase kinase. Exactly right. Now, phosphorylase kinase itself has two variations or two forms. It can be unphosphorylated and inactive, and it can be phosphorylated and active. Each of these two pools are in relative equilibrium with each other, and we're talking about shifts in equilibrium, shifts in relative predominance based on covalent bonding, based on the presence or absence of phosphate. Well, what phosphates the phosphorylase? Well, there we see the protein. See that C right there is identical to this C right here, which is identical to that C right there. And that C right there, the how much is of it is in the cell is dependent on how much what? Cyclic AMP is. How much cyclic AMP is dependent on the activity of the adenylate cyclase, which is dependent on the activity of the the alpha, stimulatory alpha subunit, which is dependent on the presence of an external signal. So, an external signal lands on the outside of the cell, modifies the G proteins to activate it, the adenylate cyclase is turned on, the amount of cyclic AMP increases, the amount of activity for the C subunit of the protein kinase A, or cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, is increased. So you see that right here, that protein kinase, R2C2, actually has two pools. Either that's inactive or active. And notice both of them are phosphorylated, which probably means that there is a phosphorylation that activates this as well, but that's not a part of this particular diagram. High levels of cyclic AMP release the regulatory subunits to allow the catalytic subunits to become active. They phosphorylate the kinase, phosphorylase kinase, which turns it on. That active enzyme then phosphorylates a pool of glycogen phosphorylase B, which phosphates it and turns it on, and you then begin to break down glucose, break down glycogen. That same enzyme will come over here and act on the pool of glycogen synthase A and move it from active, not phosphorylated, to inactive, phosphorylated. How does that turn off, ladies and gentlemen? You've had an enzyme covalently attach a regulatory molecule to an enzyme. Every bodily function that's turned on, there must be a mechanism that does what? Turn it off. You'll see that time and time again. Okay? Now, so the material that turns it on is called the phosphorylation system. The sequence that turns it off, of course, must be called the what? Dephosphorylation system. Let's take a look at the dephosphorylation system from the actual enzymes. Let's say we want to turn off the glycogen phosphorylase. That means we must remove the phosphate. If we were to turn on the synthase, we must remove the phosphate. Both of those occur using phosphoprotein phosphatase. The reason why it's called phosphoprotein phosphatase is because it can act on a variety of enzymes or a variety of proteins and remove the phosphate from it. So it's not very particular, is it? I mean, it is, but the particular things it attacks, there's a large family of proteins this thing will attack. That's why it's given the generic term phosphoprotein phosphatase. So this thing, assuming it's active, then will remove the phosphate and the glycogen synthase and activate it, make it dephosphorylated. It'll remove the phosphate from the glycogen phosphorylase, which will make it active or inactive. If you remove the phosphate from the glycogen phosphorylase, does that make it active or inactive? Shifts it toward the inactive. Then also, if you notice, it'll come over here and begin to act on the phosphorylase kinase and remove phosphates there. If it removes phosphates from the kinase, it then becomes creates an increased pool of inactive phosphorylase or kinase B. Well, what turns this on? Well, perhaps a better question might be what turns it off. Anyway, let's take the start at the top here. The kinase gets turned on. It comes down here and begins to phosphorylate a pool of phosphatase inhibitor. In other words, the phosphatase becomes inactive when it forms a dimer with an inhibitor. This dimer is in equilibrium with the phosphated form of the dimer. High levels of the phosphated inhibitor shift the equilibrium to the left and inactivate the phosphatase. That's only if that phosphate is on the inhibitor. So what happens? So the kinase comes down here, attacks the inhibitor, phosphorylates it. That means there's an increased likelihood the phosphatase will bind with its inhibitor to make the inactive dimer, which will reduce the process, reduce the phosphatase activity. That will favor the production of phosphate, of the phosphated forms. That'll favor the production of the phosphorylase. That'll favor the production of the glycogen synthase of the phosphorylated forms. So the same process, the kinase, the presence of the kinase, turns on glycogen phosphorylase, turns off the synthase, and it turns on, and it turns on the off switch, as it were, for the phosphatase. By that kinase phosphorylating the inhibitor, that reduces the amount of active phosphoprotein phosphatase. So the kinase turns on the on switch, it turns on the off switch for the release of glycogen from stores, and also and then reduces the amount of synthesis that's going on. Now, how does all that get turned off? Okay? How do you turn off the off switch? Okay? Let's see here. If I turn off the off switch, that means I've turned something what? On. The off switch here is this phosphatase. It turns off the formation of glycogen phosphorylase. It turns on the formation of glycogen synthase that's in the active form. So how does phosphoprotein phosphatase become active again? Well, it actually acts on itself. In other words, there's never a time in which there's no phosphatase in the cell. There may be a time in which this phosphatase is acting at a low activity, but there's never a time when there's no phosphatase. So low levels of this phosphatase act on its own inhibitor. What did I just say? The phosphatase acts on its what? Own inhibitor. Which means it'll come down and this pool of non-phosphorylated and phosphorylated, when this will come down and spontaneously and automatically remove the phosphate and have a tendency to shift the inhibitor to the off switch, which means that there will be less of the phosphorylated inhibitor, which will reduce the number of dimers that are inactive and increase the activity of the phosphatase. So the dephosphorylation system kind of turns itself on over time because of the phosphatase activity. That phosphatase activity then, of course, it comes in and shifts the directions of all the other glycogen phosphorylase and synthase, as well as the kinase, and then will turn off the production of glucose from glycogen and turn on the production of glycogen from glucose, depending on the external cell stimulus from its outside of the cell or from the cellular needs of the cell itself. This is why you kind of look at this as being a liver cell. Why do I look at this as being a liver cell? Glycogen's big in liver. All right? Now then, let's review. How important a role does muscle tissue play in releasing glucose from glycogen into the blood? It doesn't at all, does it? Therefore, if you have a tissue that's going to help regulate the energy status of the blood, what tissue is that going to be? The hepatic, liver. Now, adipose tissue will do fatty acids. We haven't talked about that. But in terms of carbohydrate, it's the liver. And also some fatty acids, but primarily carbohydrate. All right, so can you expect that you're going to see some interesting questions on Friday about this particular thing? Oh, yes. This is the kind of thing I love. All right. Now. Okay, I got to go back. Got to go back. Now. Dink. One piece of information I want you to add to this diagram that's not there deals with phosphorylase kinase, ladies and gentlemen. Phosphorylase kinase. That's this stuff right here. All right, this is the B form. This is the A form. What? Don't put anything. I'm just reproducing what's up here. Okay. Don't write this down. It's already up there. Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. What you need to write down is the following. Okay. One of the things that's not shown here is the it's the response of this enzyme to calcium levels. Okay. So what happens is calcium is one of the allosteric effectors that can change phosphorylase kinase B to phosphorylase kinase A. And they're literally, calcium ions bind to a subunit of the phosphorylase kinase and activate it. This occurs especially in the muscle. The muscle can store and release glycogen. Store carbohydrate as glycogen and break down carbohydrate from glycogen. It can't put it in the cell. Can't put it in the blood, but it can store it and release it for its own use. One of the most important second messengers for muscle contraction in the muscle? What is the initiating ion?
Calcium,
exactly. You're familiar with that from general biology or whatever. This has to do, if you're not familiar with it, I'll be happy to give you some resources for it. But high levels of calcium, of course, stimulate muscle contraction. What did I just say? Now, does muscle contraction require energy? So does it make sense that calcium would bind to the B form of the kinase and form it into the A form, which is stimulatory for the breakdown of glucose? Would that make sense? High levels of calcium ion are now flooding from the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the muscle cell. Contraction occurs, but the enzyme cascade dealing with the breakdown of glycogen to glucose for energy is also stimulated by that same high level of calcium ion in the muscle tissue. So, a word to the wise. Add calcium to this equilibrium between the phosphorylase kinase B and the phosphorylase kinase A. Now, if you'll notice carefully, ladies and gentlemen, they have an alpha, beta, gamma, delta subunit. Four of them in groups of four. As it turns out, one of those four, the phosphorylase kinase, one of those four contains the gamma subunit. The gamma subunit is the unit that binds the calcium. That particular subunit has a particular and peculiar name called calmodulin. Calmodulin is a widely used cassette, as it were, that binds calcium ions, four per calmodulin. Just about any enzyme that needs to bind calcium ions uses calmodulin. And calmodulin is abbreviated as C, lowercase a, M, calmodulin. This, of course, is to distinguish itself from CAM, which we haven't talked about, but stands for what? What does CAM stand for? Crassulean acid metabolism. It has to do with photosynthesis. Okay. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger. Cyclic AMP is the intracellular agent of extracellular hormones, thus the second messenger. Hormone binding stimulates the GTP binding protein, G protein releasing alpha GTP. Binding of alpha GTP stimulates adenylate cyclase to cyclic AMP. What? Oh. Is it slightly different in formatting? Okay. Well, this we've already gone over, so this is no big deal. Just fill it in. Woohoo! And that's it. Now, do you have chapter 17 ready? I have no idea if I have chapter 17 ready. Okay, close. Do I ever actually download? Do I have open? Do I have 17 available? Open, reset. There it is. Yes, right there. Da da ha 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 ha. Are you reading this quickly? This is how fast we have to go through this, okay? No, I'm just teasing. All right. Woo! Okay. Metabolism overview. This is just going to be... We've already done this kind of a thing, as it were, but we'll just go through this pretty quickly. And we probably slow down when we get to the vitamins. Vitamins are important. Vitamins will show up on the final, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately or fortunately. All right, are there similarities of metabolism between organisms? I don't think, actually, I don't think there's very many blanks to fill in here on this one, is there? I don't think there's any. Yeah. So can you just listen to me? Not really. Not if I don't have to. All right, so what is metabolism? Well, metabolism is the sum of chemical changes that convert nutrients into energy and the chemically complex products. There are hundreds of enzymes. The substrates are transformed into products via amino-specific intermediates. Metabolic maps portray the reactions. Here is a very simple metabolic map of what's going on in the cell just for energy metabolism. Well, at any rate... this will be on this quiz. Never mind. Anyway, you can see here the central line right here has to do with carbohydrate metabolism, and you can see it's central to so many other pieces of metabolism. And that's only just the half of it. That has nothing to do with any deregulation of DNA, RNA development, etc. Energy releasing pathways known as glycolysis, the citric acid cycle. Organisms show a marked similarity in the major metabolic pathways. Of course, this assumed that evidence. This is evidence that all life descended from a common ancestral form. Well, I guess. There's also significant diversity. Yes, autotrophs use carbon dioxide. Heterotrophs use organic carbon. Phototrophs use light. Chemotrophs use glucose, inorganics, and sulfur. All right, sun is the energy for life. We would not exist without the sun. This is why the Egyptians worshipped the sun. Ra. Ra, ra, re. Kick him in the knee. Ra, ra, ras. Kick him in the other knee. All right, at any rate. Sorry. You thought I was going to be naughty, didn't you? You're hoping, yes. That way we'll get 3 or 4 breakfasts between the end of the semester. We're going to go to the dean. Okay, okay. And we'd like to have eggs and we'd like to have omelets these days. Yes, exactly. All right, energy for life. Phototrophs use light to drive the synthesis of organic molecules. Heterotrophs use these building blocks. Carbon dioxide, oxygen, water are recycled. Ooh, ooh, ooh. What three things are being recycled here? Ah, oh, so carbon dioxide is being what? Recycled. You mean there is a carbon cycle on the planet? Yes. Yes, there is. I wonder, maybe having extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere isn't all that awful of a thing. But I digress. Here we go. Photoautotrophic cells take carbon dioxide and water and a little sunlight, make glucose and oxygen, heterotrophs. Break it down, and they get out energy. It doesn't show that, but it should. How do anabolic and catabolic processes form the core of metabolism? All right, so catabolism, degradative pathways, usually energy yielding. Anabolic, biosynthetic pathways, energy requiring. Also, under anabolic says energy requiring. Would you write in requires reducing agents, I guess. You put it. Energy requiring, requires reducing agents. What I want you to do here is, I want you as well, up there where it says catabolism, I want you to write ATP and NADPH. ADP produced. So you make NA, you make ATP and NADPH, and that's produced. So you produce ATP and NADH there in catabolism. One other thing I also want you to say is plus NADPH for biosynthesis. Whoops. Okay, NADPH for biosynthesis. And then under anabolism, obviously, uses ATP and NADPH. Okay, NADPH is the reduced form of nicotinamide that's required for biosynthesis. Energy production recycles NADH to make ATP. But biosynthesis, that's the making of bonds. Making of bonds requires a reductive effort, requires a deductive atmosphere. And that reduction comes from NADPH. NADPH. Now, where do you get NADPH from? You've already studied it, you just don't know it. Okay? You get NADPH from... Hold it. Wait a minute. There's only been one pathway that's had NADPH as one of the boxes you had to fill in. Which pathway was it? Don't remember? Pentose phosphate pathway. If you are making amino acids, if you're making fat, if you're making, not carbohydrate necessarily, but if you're making anything, steroids, DNA, all the nucleotides, if you're making any of it, the energy equivalents, the reductive equivalents you need to make those fresh bonds come from one molecule, and that molecule is what? NADPH. Never forget it. And the primary source for NADPH in the body, in a eukaryotic system, is what pathway? Pentose phosphate pathway. Never, ever forget it. Okay? Ever forget it. Okay? So when you get to graduate school and they ask where the reductive units are for biosynthesis, you'll know that it's what? NADPH. Now notice here. Notice they've got NADPH here. Now this is energy yielding nutrients, carbohydrates, fats, proteins, energy poor end products, carbon dioxide, water, ammonia. What happens here is you make ATP, which is required, of course, to overcome, to make bonds. That's okay. But you also need reductive units, and that's where the NADPH comes in. And that NADPH then takes these precursor molecules, amino acids, sugars, fatty acids, nitrogenous bases, many of which you can make on your own. How many amino acids can you not make on your own? You can make all but 7 of them. And those 7 are called the what? Essential amino acids. That's why you need the NADPH. You use that NADPH to make all but the 13 you can't make. Some sugars, lots of fatty acids, nitrogenous bases, proteins, polysaccharides, lipids, nucleotides. Reductive, notice the reductive part uses NADPH. Notice, is there any NADH in this process right here? Not if you're going to make anything. There is only... Now, I've learned as a biochemist through embarrassing circumstances, you never say never and you never say always when it comes to biochemistry. Because as soon as you make that proclamation, some organism somewhere is going to be doing it differently. Okay, I guarantee you. One of the exceptions for this rule here, in terms of exclusivity, that's not even a right word, but you got it. Anyway, is the urea cycle. The urea cycle, that urea cycle, the breakdown of nitrogen from an amino acid that's being recycled, can use both NADPH and NADH. That's because you cannot have a buildup of urea or cannot have a buildup of nitrogen in the body that'll kill you. So the body will use whatever reductive units are available to metabolize the nitrogen of the amino acids as they get broken down. Organizational pathways. The pathways consist of sequential steps. The enzymes may be substrate, or they may form a multi-enzyme complex, or may be membrane-bound. Research into these multi-enzyme complexes are more common than once thought. What that means here is, what typically you find is that there are enzyme activities that are clustered together. They may be separate enzymes, but they kind of organize themselves into a loose grouping, and that increases the likelihood that the substrate and products are not allowed to diffuse away rapidly. Here, if you got them separated apart, the substrate comes in, it's activated sequentially, and they've got to diffuse and then move to the next enzyme. If it's clustered, they can almost hand off the enzyme, hand off the substrate, or hand off the product as the next substrate. So that is the multi-enzyme complex. And then here on the membrane, of course, the membrane-bound enzymes are closely associated and allow for very little, if any, diffusion of the intermediates. The classic one here, of course, the electron transport system in the mitochondrial intermembrane. That's a classic system that's membrane-bound and closer together. Catabolic pathways converge to a few end products, carbon dioxide, water, and ammonia. Anabolic pathways diverge to synthesize many biomolecules. Some pathways serve as both catabolism and anabolism. Name one pathway that's both catabolic, there we go, and anabolic. You've studied it. You've memorized it. What is it? Oh, don't make us remember that stuff, Dr. Novak. It's just so unfair. There were two separate pathway metabolism quizzes I asked you to do. One was very complicated and very detail-oriented. The other pathway, using the same intermediates and enzymes, had only four different enzymes. What was that pathway that used only four different enzymes? You want to say that a little louder, Ryan?
Gluconeogenesis.
Gluconeogenesis is a reverse of what pathway? Glycolysis. Only four different enzymes. That's all it takes. Some pathways serve both anabolism and catabolism. Many times they have minor differences in terms of the enzymes, but that's the classic one. Glycolysis and what? Okay. Here we go. Now, you don't need to memorize this, but you can understand. Proteins get broken down into what? Polysaccharides get broken down into what? Sugars, primarily glucose, and they get modified to glucose. Lipids get broken down into what? Glycerol and what? Fatty acids. Where do the amino acids go? Pyruvate, acetyl-CoA, citric acid cycle, and ammonia. The fatty acids go into pyruvate, acetyl-CoA, which eventually makes carbon dioxide and water. All the carbohydrates go through that same process and eventually make carbon dioxide and water end product. There we go. Anabolism is the reverse of that. Very much comparing pathways. Anabolic pathways involving the same product are often not the same. Some steps may be in common to both. Others may be different to ensure each pathway is spontaneous. This also allows for, underline this. Okay. This allows for what? Regulation to turn what? Would it make sense to have glycolysis on and gluconeogenesis on at the same time in the same cell? You wouldn't get anywhere. What's the mechanism that turns one on, the other off? We'll discover that in the next couple days. Okay, this is a model of how it all works on. Sometimes you typically have the regulated step is early in the process. The regulated step is early in the process. That's to reduce the making of unnecessary intermediates. If you blocked it down here, you'd have to build up all these other previous intermediates. It's like when you have a garden hose attached to a house. where do you turn off the water flow overnight? Do you turn it off at the end of the hose or at the spigot? At the spigot. Why? Because you don't want the pressure on the hose overnight. It might break down and cause a leak in the hose. You turn it off at the source. That's what many of the, that's the fundamental idea behind the regulation of most pathways. You turn it off at the source. And if you don't turn off the source, you're going to figure out there's a good reason why it's not turned off at the source. Other pathways have a central intermediate. There's a particular enzyme that has to be overcome, or one turned on, the other turned off. This is a very common one. This occurs especially if the intermediates have a usefulness for other processes. This is where you might find this kind of pathway. ATP serves in a cellular energy cycle. It's energy currency to cell, and we got to go. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Come back on Friday, is that right? Okay, come prepared. Having studied Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I will have these audio tapes online by tonight.